Are we going?
It ain't hard to tell. I excel, then prevail.
Hey, what's up? How's it going? Welcome to the show, everyone. Last Exit to Brooklyn. I am your host, Tom McCaffrey, with also here with Eric B.
Mm-hmm. Big show.
Yeah, how's it going? But what's new? Before we start, rate and review this podcast. Please subscribe and please join our Patreon under LE2B.
Yeah, you should do that.
Okay. I'm sorry. What did I? I cut you off.
No. I'm just trying to get some technical thing going here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Keep going. You're doing great.
All right. Perfect. let's see. I wish I had some stuff to plug. I went to a screening of a movie that I star in on Tuesday.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was, you know, that theater Cinema Broadway. It's near like the University. Yeah, they screened it there and I went there and it was kind of funny because it was like a packed theater and it was they just reopened that theater and the guy who produced my movie, Abel Ferrara, he's this like indie director guy. And mm-hmm. He put together this like 10-day kind of festival retrospective playing mainly in his movies. And then he also played my movie but it was so funny because they made a trailer for it to promote it.
Yeah.
And it was like clips from all the movies in it. And it was like Willem Dafoe, you know, and like this movie by this guy Bertolucci, you know, did like Last Tango. And then like they show me, you know, it was just kind of.
Yeah, that's a trip.
Yeah, and it's always weird. I go to these screenings and like everyone there is really into the movie and like they kind of treat me like a big shot for the day.
Yeah, and then the next day?
Well, I mean, no, when I leave, it's over because it's like this it's like this indie film scene that like all these like big indie, you know, fans and they know that. And apparently this movie's about me being like an ex-raver in the 90s. And apparently that's a cool thing again. Raves.
Oh, yeah. When did you film this movie?
2009. And it came out in 2011.
Oh, okay.
And, but now there's like these Zoomer rave type guys who were like in the movie. So
all right.
I saw a few of them afterwards and like, you know, they're all just kind of like, hey man, hey, like it's kind of a big deal to them. So.
All right. You want me to bring in the guest?
I just wanted to talk about me for a little bit. But, yeah, I just wanted to say, all right, yeah, we can bring her in.
We'll bring in the guest. We can talk more about you because we're running a little behind. So, but yeah, we'll talk more about that. All right. So, but yeah, that's great. So you got a lot of props for that.
Oh my God.
No.
Hello.
Our guest. All right. We should introduce our guest.
Hold on. Let me get my AirPod.
we have an amazing guest for you today. Hilarious comedian, a host of the Dear Pod podcast, which is an amazing podcast. Everyone, put your hands together for Erin McGuire.
Hello, me. I'm trying to go. Here I am.
Big audience today.
Yeah.
Buddy, I know it's a good odd.
Yeah,
how's it going?
You don't think.
Where are you going?
Straight to hell. Hell that looks like Applebee's. That's
there you go.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up? Thanks for coming on.
And now she's frozen. We're having a lot of tech.
I'm glad.
Hello?
There we are.
Hold on.
She's still there.
Some of this podcast will be usable at some point.
Well, at least we got the part where I talked about me.
All right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go first.
I was just going to say, hey, how are you? We've met like briefly at Eric's shows.
Oh, yes. In the backstage area. Can you guys hear me okay? Because I am having crazy... It's a big tech clusterfuck today.
No, you sound fine now.
Okay, because my AirPods are not featuring it. So, all right.
You sound fine.
Oh, yeah, you sound good. Are you in that room where you usually do your Zoom shows?
Yes, the bar in the basement.
Where is that? Oh, it's a bar in the basement. Is that your house or someone else's house?
my house.
Yeah.
Built a bar in a basement because we wanted to make our ancestors proud.
Yeah. So when I've seen you a few, like, I don't know, like four or five times, and usually I walk in on you because you usually go up, like, it seems like you always go up first.
Well, you make it so much sexier. You walk in on me.
Yeah. Yeah, you're always like killing when I come in. So
thank you.
Do you go first? Do you ask to go first, or do they just put you first because you have to leave?
It's kind of a combination of both. And then Eric, I've just sort of like ended up bulleting. And at one point we're like, you know, I'll do a show where you're not the bullet. And I was like, I don't mind the bullet, because there's something about if you can nail it up top. I don't know. As a comic, don't you feel like it's a proud moment where you're like, yeah.
I think the hardest bullet spot.
That's why they call it the bullet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I also think it's good because I feel like it's a win-win situation, because if you don't do well, you can be like, well, it was the bullet spot. But if you do well, people think you're amazing.
It's a catch-all, really. Get-out-of-jail-free card and a badge of honor all at the same time.
Yeah, do you agree with that though? Because it's like you have an out, or you have it can go.
If I shit the bed, I don't ever blame the situation. I'm like, oh, it just I was off for this, that, and the other. It didn't have anything to do with the bullet. I don't mind doing it. Sometimes I like to go a little bit further in if I'm like taping something, because then at that point the audience is settled. That's the only thing about the bullet that I'm like, is just because they're still sort of in that place. But again, it's like there's a challenge for me as a comic where if you're not fully settled and I get your attention, I don't know. It's pretty powerful.
It's huge.
Yeah.
I think also the other thing is because you host sometimes, right? Or a lot.
Yeah.
It's always good, I think, to have the first comic who also has good hosting experience, because I feel like you become like the backup host in a lot of ways, which is a compliment, really, because you're basically doing double duty at that point.
Yeah, it's like you read it. And if they aren't fully settled from whatever the host spot was, then you just sort of use that as like a launching ramp in to go, you're on my side, get you on my side, take a couple minutes to still settle the room, and then, you know, go into your set, go into your bit. I have been emceeing a lot. I'm doing less of it lately because I want to get into a place where I was finding that, like, I like emceeing because it is a certain skill set, but it is a different skill set than, like, if you're trying to get a good tape or you're trying to get bits that are more developed. Like, I'm headlining a place at the end of the month, and I'm like, I have bits that need to be worked out. And sometimes I find when I MC, then I just like can pick up the ball and sort of abandon it in favor of it's your job right now to warm these people up.
Yeah. With the host, you have to basically, it's hard because you kind of have to do your best stuff and, you know, because you're warming up the crowd. And so, and even your best stuff when you're hosting never works as well as it does when you just do a regular set, because the audience is ice cold, really. Yeah.
They're not chilled yet. Then they're still getting in and they're getting drinks. And so you're also competing with like people talking at tables and orders and this, that, and the other.
Yeah. Do you get distracted by that? I get really easily distracted by that stuff.
Only recently, which is weird. I get a little bit more shook about it because now I'm really working hard on honing bits. So if suddenly somebody's like, I'll have a pina colada, you're like, oh God. I'm not a delicate flower in that, like, the words are so important that if one thing is lost, then I get completely thrown off. Mm-hmm.
You're not that comic.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but
I am a delicate flower.
You're a delicate flower, Catherine. I haven't seen your bits, but I'm trusting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't get really thrown as much, but recently a little bit more. Yeah.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry, but can I ask, so where did you start comedy?
I grew up in Boston, but I did sketch and improv there. I was part of an improv troupe that it was a bunch of 20-somethings and they didn't know how young I was. I was like 16 when I joined. And I
Really? Loved-
Yeah, because it was like a company that got you get paid, and I was so afraid of telling them my age for fear that they wouldn't hire me. So
how did you get into that?
I auditioned for it. They had like some sort of call, and I auditioned for it. So I did improv and sketch in Boston, but I never came up as a stand-up in Boston. But I'm Boston-based, so I have this weird... There's a weird thing about Boston comics. Like, we just have a funny, weird, offbeat sensibility. And then when I went to college, like, I've always been like 1 foot in theater and 1 foot in comedy. I started doing more theater as I was growing up, and then I went to school for it. And then I graduated, got to New York, couldn't get arrested in theater, started doing sketch again. And I was part of a sketch troupe that had this regular gig at the Westbeth Theater.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. And then it was the original. We ended up getting a regular gig at the original UCB.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And just around that time, the guys, there was a lot of ego, and the guys in the troupe were dicks to each other. And the whole thing ended up dissolving just as we got in. We were after Marc Maron.
Oh, no. Wow.
That's when you think about it. It's like, these are all the people who are something now. We didn't know who they were then. It was like, we were after Bruce Valanche for a little while, and then we were after Marc Maron, and we had all of this great momentum going. And, you know, sketch has always been sort of my like go-to, go back improv sketch thing, because I do characters all the time. And then about 8 years ago, I was like, I need to go into something that can be a hybrid of kind of everything I do. Mm-hmm. So I started doing stand-up, and then I was like, oh yeah, that's it.
What do you like it better just because it's like all you?
It is. And I, you know, it's like you love it and you hate it for the same reason. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's all me. You know, it's all how you say it. So yeah, I like that now I've embraced the fact that like I live or die on my own merit.
Yeah. And I can see now that you talk, I mean, like in your act, I can see an acting kind of background, because
she does everything. She's a great singer too. And she incorporates that in her stand up. And that's like a killer bit right there.
I love this podcast.
did that help you? Or at first, do you think when you first were starting to do stand up that you had like that background? Cause I feel like that can be helpful or hindrance.
No, that helps a lot.
It does, and yet you have to find a way to not theatricalize and your sets. It's funny.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, because sometimes if you're too theatrical, I think it cannot fit or something, but...
It doesn't feel like what you're saying is authentic.
Right. Yeah. You don't want it to sound like a prepared monologue.
No, because I see some of these actors who go into stand-up, and immediately you're watching them, and you're like, are they putting on a play right now? Because it just seems like...
It's like a one-person show, which makes me walk into traffic. I hate one-person shows. It always involves a woman not wearing shoes or some stupid shit. And I never wanted it to feel like that. And it's like, I want to use everything in my grab bag, but only if it suits whatever the bit is.
Right.
Like so, it's like I do voices all the time. That's one of my things from sketch world, but I'm not going to like randomly go, and now here's an impression of Liza Minnelli and just drop it. It's got to come out of something real. Like my Waze bit that's a guy in the backseat telling you where to go.
I know you do an impression of a Bostonian. And you don't have that accent. I feel like a lot of Bostonians I know don't seem to have the accent, or they just lose it when they come to New York on purpose. I don't know. Did you have it at one point?
No, I never did. I have always sounded like I'm from the 40s. And that's the first thing that I ever did at an open mic years ago at Grizzly Pear. I did an open mic where I was like, no one can tell where I'm from. When anyone asks me where I'm from, I just say the 1940s. I sound like I should be reading the news, like saying, our boys overseas are fighting for the girls back at home. I just have a weird voice.
Did you always sound like that? Or did that come from like training?
Or liking old movies?
Yeah, I've always had like, it's called a transcontinental accent. People think I'm from England. I've had all sorts of weird stuff. Even as a kid, though, I sounded like this and my voice was this deep. Like this deep. Like, can you imagine this coming out of a fifth grader? Being like, I'll have a slush puppy and make it fast. It was deep and it was like this. And I never thought that I had a Boston accent at all. But then my parents found a video of me playing Annie in the seventh grade. I was such a thug. Yeah. I was like, it's all right, Annie. It's all right, Molly. Annie's here.
Yeah.
Mara, kid. You know, I sounded like Matt Damon. So I guess I have more of an accent than I thought I did.
Yeah, because I...
How about them apples?
I don't like... I mean, I don't know how to say it. Like, whenever I hear, like, the Boston accent, especially in comedians, I get... It's already like a strike against the comedian. I don't know what it is. I just, for some reason, I can't like take it seriously.
Yeah, but
like I love Bill Burr, but his accent kind of makes it hard for me to listen to him. I don't know what it is.
But I think some of these guys like embellish a little bit for the stage. Like, oh, yeah. I've talked to Bill Burr off stage. You kind of turn it up for the stage a little bit. I think a lot of comics do that. So I think it's more of a character kind of situation.
Yeah. Don't you feel like you're a dialed up version of yourself?
Yeah. On stage? Definitely. Tom's not. Tom's asleep on stage.
I think I'm a dialed down version of myself. Someone said that the other day. They were like, yeah, but like, don't you have like your character on stage? Someone who doesn't ever watch me do comedy, a friend of mine. And I was like, no, I think I'm kind of, because I was like, I feel like my goal for a while was to become exactly how I am off stage, on stage, you know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know if some people are going for the opposite, but I was always like, are you still there? Is Eric frozen?
No, I'm here.
I thought you were frozen. Oh, you're just so still. You're just so bored by this story.
We're just enthralled.
Yeah. So like, I always was taking the, cause I remember running, you probably ran into this like early on. I started in LA and like, I ran into a lot of people who were like, you have to like develop a character that they can like plug into a show. And they were like, you should be like the stoner guy and you should play that. And I was like, really? I don't know if I want to like, that's kind of fake. I don't really want to be. And then I kind of started being more myself and people were like, hey man, I love that persona that you've come up with. And I'm like, this is just kind of how I talk. So,
personality, yeah. But I love a Boston accent. I'm a sucker for it. I
think it's funny, man.
It is funny. Also, because it's like, it sounds like everybody I went to high school with, it sounds like all of my uncles. It's like coming home. Like, I come from blue collar stock. All of my uncles were like firefighters and nurses, you know, and then there's me in the middle of all of it. But, they were so like earthy, and that was 100% where I got my comedy because I was also raised on weird British humor. So
were you funny young, or what was there something you wanted to young? Were you like, oh, I want to get attention by being funny? Or yeah. I'm always curious, like to hear from comedians if they were funny young, because sometimes a lot of times they weren't, but they later.
Yeah, I have a feeling you were though.
I was.
Yeah.
Well, one of the first sentences I ever put together was belly up to the bar.
Really?
So that doesn't tell you where the trajectory of my life was going from the start. Not like neurosurgeon, comedian, belly up to the bar. And when I was in second grade, I told my best friend at the time, Michelle Maroney, I said, I'm going to be a stand-up when I'm older. And this second grade Michelle Maroney said to me, there's no money in that. And, she was right, and I owe her $5,000.
She'll understand that you don't have it.
Whatever, I get paid in Dave and Buster's tickets. So
how did she have such knowledge, such accurate knowledge of the comedy industry at that age?
What kind of second grade E.F. Hutton was like, I've looked at your portfolio, it's not going to work out.
I also can't believe how spot on she was. Because I feel like young, I was probably like, oh yeah, there's a lot of money in that. Like, you know,
what?
She had her finger on the pulse of like top paying jobs, and stand up was not on her list.
Right. She's like, what does she do now? She a mime?
Esthetician. I've been stalking her a little bit on Facebook because I was like, yeah, well, what do you do? And she shoots gel into women's foreheads. So she had the right idea.
Yeah.
People don't know what comics make. You'll do some spot in the city and your friend will see you and they're like, what are you getting? Like $400 or $500 for that? And you're like, yeah, about, or
yeah, 400 pennies.
Yeah, I got a slice of pizza and a drink ticket. Ski ball tabs. I could cash those in for some Tootsie Rolls, but you know.
Yeah. So why do comedians, like, why do we keep doing it then?
Oh, come on. You can answer that question yourself after a year off.
We're emotional cutters. That's just how we roll.
Is it a thing though, where because I actually was just talking to someone today about this, about how when I first started doing stand-up, it was like my sixth bringer show and I was like not really enjoying doing it. And then I decided right before that this was my last show. And it was not a very good crowd and I did a set and I didn't do very well, but then I did a new joke at the end and it did really well. And like, that was like, oh, okay. So I kept going. So there's like a weird insecure. And I think I didn't realize why I was doing it, why I was really doing it younger. But now I'm like, oh yeah, there was like something missing. There was like a hole that, right? Because there's something's wrong. If you're doing it,
the other day I was like, we're not here because everything went well for us. None of us. Like something happened. Someone was touched. You know? So
I think it's a lot of just not being seen or something. Is that what, like, so it's either this or QAnon.
Yeah.
And QAnon, I can't, the costumes for that alone, I don't want to have to invest that much money.
Oh yeah. They're into that. Yeah.
God, it's a lot of furs, a lot of guns. I can't.
What happened to the shaman? Is he done? Is he in jail?
He's in jail, but he's in some sort of special vegan hug me jail.
Oh.
Remember?
Like, you know, the worst part is like, when that guy gets out, he probably will start doing stand up and we'll be able to tour around.
Probably. Yeah. He's opening for Cosby next month. I'm sure of it.
Oh yeah. That's hilarious. So Bill Cosby has been hinting at touring around.
Yeah, I'd be worried about the drink minimum.
It's do you think that will happen?
I'll answer that question. Yes. You can always find your audience, you know. He's not gonna go into the cellar and pop in for a spot. He's gonna go to a place where people know he's coming. I mean, and he'll get an audience, you know, of a lot of people who don't believe any of it's true.
Yeah, get ready, Texas. He's coming your way. And people would 100% go just for the freak show aspect of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, come see the bearded lady. Come see Bill Cosby. You want to come see the garbage fire.
No, I wouldn't compare. Do you remember a few years back when Charlie Sheen was doing his stand-up? Remember after he got fired? And that was kind of what that was. It was like people wanted to see this train wreck freak show, you know? Yeah. And I remember right before he did it, they go, how long are you going to do? He's like, I'm going to do about 50 minutes. And they're like, what are you going to talk about? And he's like, I'm going to wing it. That's what he said. I'm going to wing it. I'm like, oh, this is going to be bad.
Right. I've done that. I've done that a lot where I'm like, I'm just going to wing it when I get up there because I have some funny ideas.
Yeah. But you can't, if you're not a comic, you can't wing it for 50 minutes.
5-0 or 1-5.
No, a 5-0. Sorry, 5-0.
5-0 minutes of winging it with Charlie Sheen. And you know what? I'd probably still buy a ticket. I'd actually buy a ticket more so because he said he's winging it. I just want to see how the story ends.
I would have.
Well, you know what happened, though? What happened was that he couldn't do it. And then he started bringing openers in, like real comics.
Oh, wow. Accidental opportunities. He was an entrepreneur for comedians.
Well, that seemed really like kind of a smart idea. And I've always been like that when I'm like headlining or something, I'll have people going up before me and they're like, and I'm like, hey, do like as long as you want, like just keep going. Cause the longer you do, shorter I have to do. So I've always been kind of one of those, like, you know, I don't like, I'm not a run the light guy. I don't know. I want to get off as soon as possible. You know what I mean? Like, so if I get a good laugh, because you've seen this a lot where a comedian will be like the end of their set and they get a huge laugh and then they're like, oh, right. And they just keep going.
Yeah.
I'm like the opposite. I'm like, I got a good laugh. I'm out of here.
Yeah. Feel it out.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it depends on the situation. If you're crushing, but I've been in situations where I'm like, I am sweating down my ass now and they don't want me here and I don't want to be here and I'm going to cut and run. Thankfully, less and less as the years have gone by.
Well, you seem pretty good at like, I don't know. Like I said, I've seen you, like every time I've seen you, you've like done well. So like,
yeah. And I also think, you know, and Erin said she's an awesome comic, but she, and awesome comics always have great closers, and you have like several closers that you can go to. Like if you get the light, you can just throw this thing in and just close huge. I always think that's a mark of a great comic.
Oh, Eric, you are honestly my biggest fan. Like you make my day. You're really great to me. You're really great to comics. And I think that you should know that. And I think that people need to acknowledge it. And I trust you. When I get to that point where I'm headlining across the country, kid, you're coming with me. You've just been very good about giving me the time to like work. You know, I mean,
He has been, because every show I've been doing, you're on every time I walk in. So I noticed it.
But she murders on every show. I just wanted
to. Do you have her go up? Is she like one of the people you were like, oh, let's have her open the show?
I just want to be friends with her before she becomes famous. And that's, I figured I got three more weeks before I can't book her anymore. So
no, it's so appreciated. So acknowledged. I am very thankful for it because especially in the city, it's hard to get that kind of breadth of time to go work on stuff. And there's a lot of times where you feel like you can't fail in certain places. And that's not how you're gonna get any better.
Yeah,
right.
Because especially now that we've come out of the pandemic and it's like Game of Thrones for stage time, people are like, I am going to sleep with my sister and cut a penis off so that I can get 15 minutes somewhere. It's harder to come by a stretch of time that's not 5 minutes where you also feel like, well, in this 5 minutes, I have to achieve X, Y, Z. You know, in a situation where I get a little bit more time, I can still open strong, close strong, but I can use this midpoint.
Right, to work on things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I try to like really not take it for granted, really appreciate the time and use it wisely, smartly.
Yeah, I think that's for me, it seems like, especially after the pandemic, everything's changed. Like used to be, there would be a lot of small shows that you could fuck around on. Now it seems like every show there's something to lose. So yeah. I feel pressure almost on every show that I go on. Cause you go there, you're like, oh, it'll be three people. And there's like 50. You're like, what the fuck?
I know. And then you want to bring it for those people.
Not that you don't like the bigger crowds, but you like the kind of smaller crowds where you can work on things. And then every show I go on, there's like lots of people.
I know. The things that you've never thought you'd be like, oh shit, there's more people in this room.
No, I'm always like that. When I did Greenwich, I think a few weeks ago, and I think everyone was killing and it was a great crowd. And I was like, that almost made me like, I was like, oh fuck. Like it's like a weird thing where I'm like, I think a packed great crowd is almost harder. Cause like if everyone's destroying, there's so much pressure on you to do well. Cause it's like, if you don't destroy, everyone's like, what the hell happened? Whereas like less people who are pretty good, you know, there's just, I'm better in those situations. Like I don't love like a packed room where it's like every seat is full. Makes me like the pressure's on. I don't know.
I like that because I look at that and I'm like, raise your game, get excited about it. I don't know. Maybe I've been meditating too much. That's
no.
Positive. Who knew? But I walk in a room and if it's packed, it's like, it's game time. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm not like, I mean, I can do it. It's just like, I feel like I do better. I guess everyone's different. I feel like my energy does better when it's more, I kind of excel. People kind of make jokes about, I excel with like bad crowds.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is like, or just when there's like less people, I feel like I can kind of take my time more.
Or no people. Do you do great with when there's nobody in the crowd?
I do great when I'm just like alone. When I'm alone, high, watching TV, I'm like, it's amazing.
You must have been your honey spot, right?
And I'm like kind of kidding. Like, I have a lot of inside jokes, not on stage, but just in my life where like, I have decided in my head that I'm going to say something that only I understand. So it makes sense that a big crowd would kind of be like, oh, they're not going to get my head jokes.
There's something for everybody out there.
Well, I have a question for both of you, but I'll ask Aaron first, because both of you are Irish, right? I would say.
Very.
Yeah.
I'm Irish and Scottish, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there different. Like... There's a lot of funny Irish comedians over the years. Is there a certain type of, is there an Irish humor that's, I don't know, different from a different type of humor?
Well, or... I'm Irish and English.
Oh, okay. So that's, well.
Raised in Boston. And this makes for a very weird person. Like, and I'm French Canadian. So like all of the weirdest people.
Yeah. The whitest countries in the world right there.
Yeah. It's like, I'm white on white on white. I'm mayonnaise on white bread. This is why I implode in the sun. But I think you're a product of how you're raised, your situation. And I was raised with a British, my parents are very weird. Mm-hmm. They still are. And they raised me on British television.
So what would be an example? What would be an example?
Benny Hill.
Okay.
Kid is raised on Benny Hill.
They wanted you to watch that?
Oh, just like that's what everybody watched. It was like Benny Hill, Monty Python. You know, as I got older, SNL, Kids in the Hall,
Malty Towers. Was that a thing?
That was present in the home. Yes, I like that. I'm talking about it like it's an abuse story. I'm telling you, like, they made me watch Benny Hill and women with boobs.
I remember young, like seeing Benny Hill when they were flipping through, seeing Benny Hill on TV and being like, oh, Benny Hill. And I was like 10 and they like looked at me horrified. They were like, how do you know that? Like mad that I had seen that.
Exactly. Meanwhile, I'm like, oh, let's watch that one again. Chase the chick with the huge decans. Let's do it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, your parents are dragging you into the room to watch it.
Oh, make me. I think yeah, I don't know if it's like an Irish comedian thing or as much as like a Boston thing.
Maybe it's a Boston thing, yeah. Or an English, like you said, which side is English and which side is Irish for you?
English and Irish on my father's side, Austrian, French, Canadian on my mother's side.
Oh, okay.
Well, English comedy, there's a good history of like English, of good English comedy, right? Like the whole Monty Python.
Yep.
I mean, that's
what I'm always drawn to. Always. Eddie Izzard is one of my favorite comedians.
Oh, he's a genius.
Yeah. And because I think they're so smart. I don't know. There's just something like headier, weirder, stranger, quirky, left of center.
I think a thing with them that made them stand out is I do feel like if you're starting with like an English accent, you immediately kind of get everyone's attention. It's kind of like if you're an English dude, like meeting a woman in America, like if you have the English accent, yeah. You're already kind of, you're one step above everyone, but
you're getting laid.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely. I mean, that is a thing.
Yeah. And that's why I'm developing a joke that I need to find 20 more jokes for. But the fact that I trust British people more than anybody in the world. I just love a British accent, and they're the only ones who can read me the news.
Yeah.
They could literally whisper in my ear being like, this is your last day on earth. And I'd be like,
yeah,
it's fun.
Even like an English guy breaking up with you would sound pretty good.
Like, it's my fault. I'm sorry. I'm not British.
Right. Right.
Continental accent.
I have another question for you. So you're married to an actor, right?
Yeah. God help me.
And you talk about it in your act, and he was in The Lion King, right?
He's going back.
Oh, that's cool. So you guys probably have a lot in common. Like, does he watch your shows? Does he come to your comedy shows at all or no?
He was the one who was like, you should be doing this.
Oh, that's nice.
He forced me by gunpoint. And it's an abusive relationship, and I'm going to blink twice if I need to get out of it. Yeah, he is a huge stand-up fan. And when we first started dating, anytime like we got in a car or whatever, he was always listening to it, to the point where I was like, all right, you gotta, can't we put on some Jay-Z or something?
Yeah.
And huge stand-up fan. And as a result, I was just like hearing so much of it all the time. And he's obsessed with watching what this is, because again, like, we're entertainment industry, but it's not the same thing at all. So it's been fun for him to go and watch what the process is. And I don't know. He's like the biggest fan of stand-up.
Wait, so you've done both. So what would you say are the main differences between it, like stand-up and acting?
Aside from the fact that you live and die on your own merit and your own words, I mean...
What do you think is harder?
Stand-up, easily, in a heartbeat. Because, and I've said this to him...
It is, yeah, it definitely is.
About anything, I'm like, oh, isn't it so nice that you get to go to a place where the words are written for you and somebody else has made your costumes? It is much easier on the acting side of things. And I've dipped back and forth throughout. Only in the past few years has it been like pure stand-up. But I had the chance to do right before the pandemic, and I'm talking like a week before everything shut down. I did a full run of Act of God, which was written by David Jabberbaum. So It was the moment where I felt like...
Wait, is that the comedy writer?
Yeah, yeah.
The guy, the one who's the Twitter account, and he used to write for The Daily Show?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
And I just, there's a theater knew me, asked me to do it. They were like, we want you to come here and play God. And I was like, well, the role I was born to play. You don't say no to that if something fits. And so it was wild to walk back into theater to do that, but also to do a play that was written by a comic writer.
And he's like a genius, right?
I can't say enough awesome stuff about this play. So it's just you. You're on your own. 40 something pages, like packed words. And I got it right away. Like I understood his words, and I wouldn't have been able to do that had I not been doing what I'm doing. Because it was written with a stand-up comedic voice in mind.
Oh, okay.
I went to go a way to do this, and then he reached out to me on Twitter.
Oh,
he found me.
Really?
Yeah, it was wild. I was like, oh, you know, when you don't think that people are watching what you're doing, he reached out on Twitter and he was like, I see you're doing Act of God, very excited, blah, blah, blah. So he has started to watch my stand up.
Oh, that's a big fan right there.
Yeah, it's wild. And we've just been back and forth a lot on Twitter, which has been awesome. You know, there's part of it that's like, for free.
This was a guy, I think he wrote for The Onion first, and then Jon Stewart hired him. And he was the one who, like, one of the writers who turned the Jon Stewart show into a great thing.
Yeah.
And he's like a genius, this guy. And he has this Twitter account called, what's it called? Tweet of God or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I guess he turned it into a play, which I never knew.
Yeah, it was the springboard for Act of God.
Right.
So you see a lot of the tweets you're basically reading some of the tweets within the content.
Oh, and those were really funny. So that must have been hilarious.
Such a funny play. It is so well written. It's so smart.
How long is it?
Took about an hour, a little bit over an hour. But to do the whole run of it, I would do it again in a heartbeat wherever they wanted. And then through us connecting on Twitter, I found out like his family lives not far from me. And I was doing a night in a Jersey theater outdoors during the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
Didn't have any entertainment. So I was like, I'll go and do this thing outside, and he and his family were going to come to it. So, and then they were like, or we could accidentally die if we go to this thing. We were not vaccinated, but yeah, it's cool to see how all the worlds can collide like that. And that it made so much sense. I've never read a play that made so much sense to me.
Oh, that
can I, so, and this is, so, you know, you're talking about, you know, stand-up is so much harder. Because stand-up, I think, is probably one of the hardest things, just in performing, definitely, but just in the world to do well. Why do you think, I feel like people don't look at it as difficult.
Because they don't know the work that goes into it, and they really don't know the behind-the-scenes stuff. You are your own motor. Like, it's not happening if you're not pushing the train down.
And why do you think, it's just people look at comedy? And I think that they just think of it, it's kind of like when they got James Franco and Anne Hathaway to host the Oscars. I think they were just kind of like, well, they're funny. So it's just talking. So you just get up there and say things. So that's all it is.
And everybody in the world should be forced to do it once to see how much to be respected for the people who do it well. And I think unless you are somebody who is, you know, a name that's household, like a Sarah Silverman or a Jim Gaffigan or whatever, unless you are that, they don't understand the nuances. You don't know how hard you have to work to make it look like it's not work.
I know that's what people don't understand. That's what's so you don't realize. I think I just realized this in the last few years, where like, you know, someone like, you know, Louis C.K., when I would watch him, you know, he looks like he's just talking and making it up, but he knows exactly what he's, because I have jokes like that too. And I'm sure you do too, where it does sound like I'm just coming up with it, but I've done it that way every time. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this, where like, sometimes I kind of will be like, oh, well, I know this well. And I'll throw in like another word. And it's weird. It like will throw me off. Like, I'll be like, where am I? I just wait. This one word completely took what?
You feel the speed bump. As soon as you do that, you're like, oh shit.
Yeah, it's weird. And it'll be jokes that I've done years and years. I know so well. And I'm like, I can kind of riff on this. And then it's like, oh shit, I don't know what I do next.
Well, you know what the pandemic taught me was during doing these Zoom shows, I would write all my material down, like every word. You know, you would sometimes you just read your jokes, and that actually really helped me. And then like a few weeks ago, I saw that you left, Aaron, you left your set out.
Nightmare.
She left it at the club, and she had every, like, just a whole set written out. Like, it took me three sentences, and I started seeing references to Ginger. I'm like, oh, I know who this is. But then I saw that's really how you should do it, because that Zoom stuff helped me reading my jokes and getting every word perfect. When you fuck up just one word, it fucks up jokes. It's when you, like, I'm doing that now, what you just did. I'm writing things out because I used to do that, and I forgot to do that.
I remember I did that early on, and I was like, wait, is this, I don't think this is how you're supposed to do this. So
no, yeah. I disagree. I think it's,
I thought at the time, but yeah, I don't know. That's, I think that made me, when I did that, it's because I had like studied acting, and that felt like an acty thing. Like, oh, I'm writing out an entire script that doesn't seem to fit, but yeah.
No, I just think it's like about word economy and getting every word right. And yeah, you realize when you start just kind of shooting from the hip up there and you miss a word or you add a word, it screws up your joke. So it's good, I think, to kind of just go over every word. Is that your process or no?
Now it's become it because of the pandemic.
Right.
I said that I have become a better comic as a result of Zoom shows. Because when this thing first started, I did the first Zoom show and I was doing all my usual shtick from before. And I was like, this feels awful. Because it's like it took all of my crutches away. And then I realized, oh, when you're like an inch away from a screen, you can see for yourself all the things that are not working. You can hear it for yourself. And you can't rely on an audience in a Zoom show. You know, it's like people are muted or their videos are off. It's been like, okay, here's a box, perform in the box and let's see what happens. And as a result of all that, yeah, I did the same thing. So it's like I would, during the Zoom times, I type out all of my stuff and I just read it right there. And then I'm not even looking at myself at first. And then
right,
I record it and then I'll go back and sort of watch. I've become much more, because of the pandemic and because of Zoom shows and realizing that an economy of words is so important for me, to get more punch.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, just get to the fucking point. Like when I look at some of my old sets, I'm like, ugh. shut up, like, or move it along, like, get to it, you know? Anything you're saying, is it that important or is it that funny? And it, yeah, so now I'm doing a lot more, let's write this whole thing out and then let's go back in and see where I could take things out. Like, so what you saw, oh my God, Eric, that's my biggest nightmare. I'm like, somebody is going to find my joke book and be like, this is a sociopath. What is this about the game, the board game operation? What the Jurassic Park? What's happening? But so now I'm typing everything out.
And then yeah, I think it's a really good, you're not memorizing. I mean, you're just reading the words to make sure you're saying them correctly. You're not regurgitating the words. You've done comedy long enough where you're not just reading it and regurgitating it. You're just remembering to say everything at the right time. I think it's helped me a lot. And I see a lot of comics doing that now. I think it's I don't think you have to do it, but I think it works.
It's not a script. It's like a guidepost. And everybody, you start to figure out, I especially feel like I'm at the point in this game where I'm starting to figure out more what my thing is as far as like my approach to, okay, I think that in the beginning I was like, well, I can fly and I can fuck around and I'll just see and I'll figure it out on stage.
Yeah.
And then I'm going, oh, I can do a little bit of that. You know, it's like Tig Notaro. I remember her saying in an interview, she's like, I'll just write down a word and then I'll go up on stage and I'll sort of riff on whatever that idea is. But I think I need a little bit more form than that.
Yeah. I don't think that's,
yeah, I need to know that I got certain things that I can land on.
I need more of like, I need to already have like a pretty solid structure of a joke that maybe sometimes I'll be like, yeah, I have the beginning of that. And then maybe I can kind of riff on it. But I think what I do, instead of writing it all down and going through it, I like just keep recording myself and I'll just say it. I do it a lot just out loud, not in front of people. And that helps me. Yeah, it's kind of like that, but I'm doing it just like, instead of writing it down. For some reason, writing the whole thing down seems like a lot of work to me.
I don't want to be so, especially when I'm figuring out a new joke or whatever, I don't want to be so structured about it.
Right.
This is, to quote my guy, Eddie Izzard, I like to keep it molten, not leaden.
That's good.
So if it's got some flex to it, then as you're figuring it out on stage and you're like, oh my God, there's a joke right there. I was like, I made a joke about the fact that someone told me I reminded them of Eleanor Roosevelt. And then I was just thinking about it on stage as I was saying, I was like, God, did you ever see a picture of him? And it's such a small thing that sometimes gets a response. Sometimes.
Oh yeah.
But I'm like, that's a moment of saying, I know where I'm going. And now I'm just going to like flex it out a little bit. I'm going to keep it a little bit loose in my head.
And then honestly, I still learn from just watching great comedians.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's how a lot of my still learning comedy is, like, yeah. Just watching what they do and how they, I mean, that's how I guess everyone kind of starts. That's definitely how I started, but usually you stop doing that. But then like a few years ago, I just started rewatching all the great comedians, and it is, you can learn a lot still.
But I also think, just back to Zoom for a minute, because both of you guys were really good at Zoom shows. And I think Zoom shows taught comics how to write jokes better.
Yep.
You know, and that.
I like Zoom shows.
Yeah,
People are always like, it's all jokes.
It's all about the jokes, you know, and the guys who were crazy act out guys. Not that that's a bad thing. If that's the only thing they did, they were in trouble on Zoom because that just didn't work on Zoom.
Yeah, it didn't fly. And I thought, it showed me, it poked holes in all of my stuff.
Wow.
Because I got to see it for the first time, be like, oh, I'm relying too much on this.
And I really liked that you could just mute someone in the audience. Like, instead of having to deal with hecklers, they could just mute them.
That live. That's
exactly. I mean,
a mute.
And I wasn't like a big, like, I can do crowd work, but you know, a lot of people will ask me when, like, oh, like, do you like to mess around with the crowd? And I'm like, look, I didn't get into stand up to talk to people. So the whole point was that I'm the loudest in the room and no one else can be heard. So I don't like I can do crowd work. I just would prefer not to do it.
And see, going into the pandemic, I was getting a little too crowd worky because I was hosting so much that I was not paying attention to how to establish my own stuff and my own self, because I was busy looking at what was happening right in front of me, which again is a good, it's a great skill to have, to be quick on your feet like that and to be able to respond. But I also want to be able to develop my own material in a way where I can headline and not be scared that I'd need to fill any time with the audience.
Yeah. And
you
stage and not rely on that.
Yeah. And you just use the crowd work if you need it, if the crowd's fucked up or whatever. But yeah, you need to have an hour of material if you're going to headline.
Yeah. Especially in theater spaces. Like, have you ever, you guys done stand like a theater space where you can't even like see the audience. The audience can't see each other. It's not like you're in a club. It's not really tight. And I've come into shows like that, not feeling ready with my own stuff enough to be able to just have confidence that this was enough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of went, I need to really focus on, if you're in a theater, what are the bits?
Can I ask you something? So I read that you did the Lucille Ball Comedy Festival.
Awesome.
What is that exactly? Like, is that
it's a really prestigious, cool festival, and they get amazing talent. And it surprised the hell out of me when it, like, an offer came out of nowhere, and I was like, well, yeah, absolutely. It was probably 3 or 4 years in, maybe.
Did you, is it strictly women comedians, or is it like all runs the gamut?
No,
yeah,
everybody. And they get amazing talent. But this one specifically was a big deal because they were opening the National Comedy Center.
Oh, yeah.
So it was colliding. They were doing the festival at the same weekend that they were opening this big center. So they had crazy names in, and I still have the t-shirt. I have a picture of the t-shirt. They did not give us this t-shirt, and it killed me because the list of the comics were on the back, and I was underneath Lily Tomlin.
Wow.
Wow. Really? Like,
this is because they had half of the original cast of SNL there. Dan Aykroyd was there. Lorraine Newman. God.
So was that like intimidating?
It was nerve wracking a little bit because I wasn't, those shows that we were on, it was like they had, there was like the Copacabana room or something, and it was showcase shows. But the showcase shows, it was like me, Dulce Sloan, Pete Lee, Sarah Tomash. I was on like 3 different ones, and it ended up being this crazy weekend where you're just like hobnobbing with some of the best.
Wow.
And you know, we were all part of this big long weekend, so you were invited to all of these cool events, and it was just cool to be able to like mingle and go, oh, I'm here with everybody, and I have to step up to the plate.
Nice. Yeah,
sure. It went well. We probably gonna have to wrap up soon. I just wanted to say one other thing. You want to talk about your podcast real quick, and then we'll wrap this up, because I thought it was interesting. It was actually really hilarious.
Oh, have you listened to my pod?
Just today.
Oh, I haven't listened to it.
You're going to be a fan.
Yeah. It's called, but it's comedy. It's comedy and
as funny. It's the Comedy Advice Podcast. It's been getting funnier and funnier because I feel like we found our groove during the pandemic.
Kind of advice do you give?
We unearth the articles of Ann Landers and Dear Abby.
Wow, that's so funny.
My friend Patty, who is not a comic, like at all. He's like a model. He's gorgeous. But he's just this dry Irish gay man. Mm-hmm. And two of us read these advice columns, Ann Landers, Dear Abby. We come up with a different theme every week. Very excited about the one we're recording this weekend. It's obscene phone calls. It's going to be endlessly funny. But basically, it's just like a launch pad for us to be jackasses and talk about whatever the theme is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's cool to go back and find these articles that are so bonkers, and the things that people were asking these women and the advice they gave them, and it's just not woke at all.
Oh yeah, it was probably like very anti-feminist, right? I would imagine.
All of it would like was right. So wrong. It's just hysterical. So that's what we do. We talk the advice articles, but basically, and then it's all sort of like 1950s inspired. And every week we take a listener mail question, so we give advice in the same way that they did with their voice, and then we develop a specialty cocktail to fit the theme every week. And we'll be coming out with this fall a book of them, because we've got like hundreds of them.
So do people ever write you specifically for advice?
Not me, the person, but me, the podcast. Yes. You can email the podcast and it's like, dear pod, here's my advice question, et cetera.
And are they like legitimate? Do you give them advice?
Yeah. Well, I give them the jackass advice. I give them the funny, comedic, ridiculous, over the top.
But let's say someone said that, my husband is cheating on me with three different women. Like, what would you say? Would you give like
an asshole? Get out. What are you thinking?
Oh, okay.
Get money in a court of law. Yeah, okay. I'll give you the jackass answer and everything. It's not serious advice that we give.
No, I just figured if it was like 1950s, you'd be like, no, you have to stay with him.
Well, stay with the man and then make him some dinner and then kick him to the curb.
Oh.
Get his money and run. That seems to be the theme. But yeah, I love it. We do it. We have a new one every week. It drops Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard.
And nice.
We have a website, Dear Pod Official, where we have every last episode. And we actually, in our first month on the air, made Apple's top 100 comedy podcasts.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Yeah, we were right under Last Podcast on the Left. I was very surprised.
Wow.
Happy about that. I know. So,
weren't we on some list at some point, Tom?
We're on, we're usually on the, under the, I know it sounds like I'm lying, but it's, in the stand-up comedy section, they have like a section on, you know, Apple Pods, and we're usually in they put the top 60. We're usually in like about like 40, between 40 and 60.
Well, yeah. Well, we are trending in Korea right now. I don't mean to brag.
We do well in Korea too. Yeah. We sometimes get on the charts in Korea, and I get these things sometimes, these emails like Canada, and I don't know. It's so weird. The idea that people are, I still am trying to understand. Now
we're huge, man. We can't walk down the streets of Basra where that big.
Let me tell you what I get every time I go to Guam. I can't do what I need to do because people are like, oh my God, dear pod.
I can't talk out loud in Belgium or else they all recognize me.
All right. We should probably wrap this up. I'm sure you have things to do and we all do. So this was great. I guess you gave your plugs. You want to plug anything else?
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, follow me online at Erin McGuire Official, because that's on Instagram, where I'm posting lots of clips now and anything, any upcoming tour dates. I've made a link tree because I think I'm fancy.
Yeah, so,
yeah, find me. Always Erin McGuire Official. It's the easiest thing. M-A-G-U-I-R-E, like Jerry Maguire, which I thought that movie would change everything for me. And then Mark McGuire came along and screwed everything.
Why is he MCG?
He's got like a Q and a W.
Yeah, he does have a weird. Yeah, it is weird how that gets so confused. It does become confusing. You're like, I don't know what's next.
Like, son of a bitch. They were just starting to learn.
It's weird. People get these Irish names wrong. Like, people will call me McCafferty all the time. Or they always spell it. Mine is R-E-Y. They spell it E-R-Y every time. And
someone brought me up to the stage by saying Erin McGuire. And if that is not my most ethnic sounding name, I don't know what is.
That's what you should go by. Like, how, you know, people do that where they like Ray Fiennes, where they have it pronounced in a different way.
Yeah, Rafe. That guy.
I still don't understand how he got everyone to do that when it's spelled Ralph.
Oh, Rafe Fiennes?
He's British. Yeah. So it's like if a British person says, no, it's pronounced Rafe, you're like, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. So it all comes full circle. Yeah. Like, I couldn't do that. Just like an American guy, like, no, my name's not Tom, it's Twom. You know, people are like, they'd be like, yeah, whatever, Tom.
feel like you're bullshit. But if you say it with a British accent, I believe you.
Right. Like, I couldn't be like, my name's not Tom, it's Rafe.
Well, you guys, thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Awesome job.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. Aaron McGuire.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time on LE2B, Last Exit to Brooklyn. Thanks again.
Yeah.